Let's call this meeting to order. All right, the meeting is called to order. Should we start out with the Pledge of Allegiance?
Yes.
Repeat after me. Ready? Begin. I pledge allegiance to the flag
of the United
States of America
and to the Republic
for which it stands,
one nation,
under God,
indivisible,
with
liberty and justice for all. All right, thanks everybody. Do the board member roll call.
All right, Gloria Alvarado.
Present.
Trung Lee.
Here.
There you go. John Luker.
Here.
Doug Mangione.
Here.
Carlos Oregon.
Here.
And Kathy Boyd.
Here.
Okay, all members are present. We do have a quorum.
I do have to give my thanks to the Youth Committee. We were all at the board meeting recently, and therefore we were able to have this meeting virtually, which is great. So thank you, everyone. At this moment, I guess we'll call for any public comments. Is there any public comments?
Let's see if anyone would like to make a address the board, the committee, would you please raise your hand in the Zoom meeting? If you're calling in, you can hit *9 or unmute yourself with *6. Again, if you'd like to address the committee, you can raise your hand. All right, does not look like anyone is raising their hand at this point.
All right, seeing no public comments, we'll move to the action items. The first action item is AB 361, review and make findings required by government code subsection 54953E3 to continue virtual meetings due to the proclaimed state of emergency arising from COVID-19. Meeting in person presents imminent risk to the health and safety of attendees, and the emergency continues to directly impact the ability of the members to meet safely in person. Can I get a motion to approve this action item?
Motion.
I'll move.
Second.
A first and a second from Doug. All in favor?
Aye.
Oh,
aye. Aye.
Do we need to vote individually?
John, we have to do roll call with action.
Okay, we'll do a roll call.
So Adriana, okay. Call out the names.
Gloria Alvarado?
Yes.
Trung Lee?
Aye.
John Luker?
Aye.
Doug Mangione?
Aye.
Carlos Oregon?
Aye.
Kathy Boyd?
Aye.
All right. Motion passes.
Motion passes unanimously. Thank you. So next item is the co-enrollment policy. Carmen, do you want to go over this or?
Yes. So prior to today, we haven't had a co-enrollment policy that covers all types of co-enrollment, meaning that co-enrollment is where we may enroll a participant from another partner agency's program. That's typically how they've seen co-enrollment, but over the years, co-enrollment has expanded. Co-enrollment can include us enrolling someone from the Santa Ana or the Anaheim Workforce Boards all the way to LA County and our program. So enrolling them in both WIOA programs at the same time, so identifying how that could work and that it is in fact possible. Co-enrollment also includes when we have programs like VEEP, enrolling a participant in our VEEP program and our WIOA formula funds. So what this policy is designed to do is to cover all types of co-enrollment and establish the standards for co-enrollment and what our expectations are for our service providers and our staff in regards to co-enrollment. I will share with you that the state has asked for a copy of our co-enrollment policy to share with other workforce areas because I think it's been a challenge quite a few places. One of which I know Santa Barbara also asked us for a copy of it. So once this policy is approved, I will be sharing it with the state and they will be sharing it with other workforce areas to use as their, template for co-enrollment and how co-enrollment should work within programs. So if you look at it, there are four types of co-enrollment. Like I mentioned before, there's the internal co-enrollment between our internal programs. There's in co-enrollment with system partners. As you know, in the One Stop Center, we have 17 system partners, as well as community-based organizations that may benefit from having a participant in their program and ours at the same time. There's also the co-enrollment with another local board. So like I said, Santa Ana, all the way to San Diego, all the way to LA. If we enroll a participant in both workforce systems, how that will work, and then co-enrollment with a non-workforce development board system partner. So sometimes there will be community-based organizations that will want to utilize our program, but not participate in our system, meaning they don't want to be a one-stop partner, but they may benefit from enrolling their client in our program. And so we identify how information will be shared. A good example of that is maybe a church. Maybe a church has a program where they're supporting an individual, but wants to utilize our WIOA services. So this policy identifies exactly how will that work. Are there any questions or concerns in regards to the co-enrollment policy and the purpose of it?
So do all the work boards use a similar or the same client tracking system, and then they're able to see what's going on?
Yes and no. So once a participant is enrolled in a Workforce Development Board's program, they are required to put them in CalJobs. So all of the workforce boards have CalJobs. What we are doing locally is that we're putting our partners. So for example, DOR is one of our system partners. When DOR makes a referral to one of our programs, we're using CalJobs to do that. Other workforce boards aren't necessarily doing that yet. We are a pilot for the state in regards to using CalJobs to track referrals. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah.
Chung Lee can tell you that from his experience that we are doing something like that.
Now, any cross collaboration between entities is definitely the way things need to be moving. So that's great. Is there any other questions regarding the policy for Karma or the team? Hearing none, I will call for a vote to approve this policy. Can I get a motion to approve?
Motion, Karen.
Can I get a second?
Chair Luker, just so the recommendation is to approve policies listed in 6 and 7. So I recommend going on to 7 and then doing one vote for both policies, please.
All right. You want to go over the next policy, Karma?
Okay, so the next policy is our invoice review standards. So as you know, we've had quite a few compliance findings over the years. And one of our strategies to resolve some of those open compliance findings is to create policies and procedures that ensure that moving forward, we have the right practices in place. So the invoice review policy is our internal policy that we would use and we share with our service providers of how invoices are reviewed. All of our contracts, as you know, are cost reimbursable, which means that the service provider must demonstrate that they've in fact incurred that cost, actually paid that debt in order for them to seek reimbursement. We do not do a reimbursements on accruals. It has to be actual costs in order for it to meet the cost reimbursement standards. And so with that, there are some requirements that we have to have in place to support that yes, in fact, costs actually happen. And here's the documentation that we'll require in order to support that expense. So this policy is developing framework or our standard of how our invoices are reviewed and what is acceptable forms of documentation to ensure that we are in fact reimbursing service providers for number one, allowable costs, for allocable costs, and for costs that are related to the program that we've provided funding for. I can answer any questions that you have about it, but essentially it's developing a standard. We did not have this in place before in terms of what our standards are. We typically went through the county's accounting process, and it's a little different than what we need for WIOA. And so this policy helps support, like I said, compliance findings, creates a standard, and allows our service providers to understand what is acceptable forms of documentation and what is acceptable forms of expenses.
So if a contractor towards the end of a contract incurs an expense and they're not in, let's say they're invoiced at the end of the contract, but pay it after the contract, that cost is then not reimbursable, or can they provide proof that they paid it after the contract ended?
That's a great question. So here's how it works. So there is a closeout period. So for example, let's say the contract ends on June 30th. There is a anywhere from 30-day to 60-day closeout period where the service provider must present all of their invoices. So that would be, the 30 days would be August, right? And then after that would be September. So the latest they could send it is in September for an expense that occurred in June. No, well, how did I say that wrong? July, I think you get it. But essentially there is a period where they're allowed to submit invoices for reimbursement for that end period. Now, after that period, if they've missed it, then unfortunately we can't pay it because we've created a standard and the money is no longer available. So remember, our funding has timelines to them. And if you submit an invoice after the timeline has expired, we don't have a way for paying for it because all of our money is allocated per program year and program pot. Does that make sense? So if I receive WIOA funding for a certain time frame, I have to spend it within that time frame. And if I don't, I have to return it back to the state.
That makes sense. I mean, so a contractor has, you say 30 days or 60 days? They have.
It depends on the contract. Usually it's about 60 days, but it depends on the contract and what pot of funding we made available to them.
Okay. So 30 to 60 days they have to pay the bill in order to get it reimbursed for that contract term. That seems reasonable.
And we provide them with notice. So before the contract ends, we give them a closeout notice saying, as a reminder, your contract is going to close on June 30th. Here are the deadlines for you to submit all your invoices. Here are the program files that we'll need. Like, we give them notice that their contract is about to close and what we require in order for them to meet the standards. So they get a notice not only from our department, but also from our fiscal department.
Yeah. Any questions on this invoice review policy from anyone else?
Yeah, not a question, but a comment. I know part of our purview is where we're really watching where tax dollars get spent. And this is you know, very substantial. Anyone that utilizes money should have all these forms. So I applaud the way this is put together, and you're all watching the store. So thanks as a taxpayer.
Thanks.
Anyone else? All right, we have two policies that have been presented, the co-enrollment policy and the invoice review policy. So I'll call for a motion to approve those two policies.
I'll move.
That's Doug's first. Can I get a second?
Second.
Sean has seconded, so we're going to do a roll call vote.
Gloria Alvarado.
Yay.
Trung Lee.
Aye.
John Luker.
Approve.
Doug Mangione.
Aye.
Carlos Odegaard.
Approved.
And Kathy Boyd.
Approved.
All right, two policies are approved. Move on to the information items, program performance.
Thank you. I'm going to ask that you advance to page 24 of the packet. And then I'm going to ask if you could advance Maggie up. Maggie Lopez will be providing an overview of performance for the WIOA Youth Program, or Ready, Settle, Seed Program, excuse me.
Good morning. For quarter two, from October 1st through December 31st, for our in-school program, we have no expenditures to report as invoices were not received for that quarter. Invoices have been received since, but nothing was paid up through December 31st. For new enrollments, we actually had 7 enrollments, putting us at 15 out of the 114 that they required, only 13%. Co-enrollments or carry forwards, we had 1 for a total of 56 carry-ins, which are the youth that were enrolled from previous program year. They're still being served. For youth placements, whether it be education, military, apprenticeship, or trade placements. We had two for a total of three out of the 116, putting them at 3%. And then we had seven new participants that actually were placed into work experience, putting us at 42 out of the 75, putting us at 56%. And then program exits, we had 10 for a total of 12 out of the 38 for the program year, putting us at 32%. Can you scroll down? And then for the new participants that were enrolled for the quarter, all of them received services and or class, workshop, or training services within that first week of enrollment. And then we had one youth placed into an ITA, which is an individual training account, and whatever they selected to assist them. Yes.
Before you advance, I want to share with this board, because it probably is very alarming that there is no expenses. We did write a corrective action letter to the service provider to notify them that they're outside of the scope of the contract. The contract requires that they submit an invoice every 30 days. And as Maggie said, that as of the second quarter of this contract year, they had no invoices submitted. So we did, in fact, ask them to send a corrective action of how they're going to fix this situation. I believe the service provider did respond and submitted some invoices just recently, I believe as recent as this week, in which we're in the process of reviewing and approving. But I just wanted to bring that to your attention, because this is a red flag. We are halfway through this contract year, and with no expenditures, it's hard to say how they're performing in terms of fiscal performance, in addition to actual just program performance. So I wanted to highlight to you what we've done. I don't know if this committee wants to see those corrective action letters when we send them out to service providers. We can share that with you. It will be probably a lot with some of the service providers, because as we do desk reviews and realize things are outside of the scope of their contracts or not in compliance with the law, my team has been writing desk review corrective action letters to address those issues. So I say this all to ask the board, would you like to see them or not? But then to also provide you notice that we are doing something about it, that we're not just ignoring or dismissing the fact that we're within the second quarter of this contract and still no invoices were submitted.
I mean, I don't know how the rest of the committee feels, but I mean, I don't necessarily feel like we need to see every corrective action notice. And I think that's the point of these meetings, that you can kind of give us an update and tell us how things are going, but maybe others feel differently. I don't know.
I agree with John. We do need to know about this. That was my thought. I figured they haven't submitted invoices, but then, you know, that just makes your accounting harder, because at the end of a program, they're going to submit all the invoices and all, you folks are doing the right thing. I agree. I don't need to see every letter you send, but I appreciate that when we meet, that we're being informed.
I agree too. Totally agree.
And Maggie, you can continue.
Okay, can we? So for out of school, same thing applies. No invoices were received or paid for that quarter. For enrollments, they had 36 new enrollments, putting them at a year to date of 98 out of the 334, bringing them up to 29%. And then for placements, they had four for a total of six out of the 347, putting them at 2%. Attainment of certificate or degree, they had 22. Out of the 315, putting them at 7%, which was a big jump. They had a lot of graduates this quarter or last quarter. For literacy numeracy gain, they had 17 out of the 217, putting them at 19 out of the 225 for 8%. And then retention with the same employer and or education, they had one out of the 315, so still at 0%, because it's such a low number. For work experience, they had nine new participants placed for a total of 41 out of the 225, bringing them to 18%. And then program exits, they actually had 38, putting them at 44 out of the 113, bringing them up to 30%. Out of the 36 new enrollments that they had for the quarter, all of them were provided services and or some sort of training within that first week of enrollment. And then they had a total of one new placement for ITAs, putting them at a year to date of seven, and no JTs yet as of the quarter. And we actually have La Habra staff available in case you guys have any questions for them.
Does the panel have any questions for them? Obviously, you know, last time we met, obviously we were hoping for more improvements on performance. I mean, I'm assuming, I guess you can speak to it yourselves, that the recent surge has hampered that. Do we want to just give them a chance to kind of talk about the challenges that they're facing?
John, I have just a couple of questions. The median earnings that are shown, what is the time frame of that? Is that a monthly, quarterly? What is that number?
So that's actually medium earnings for their second quarter after exit. And okay. For this quarter, I forgot to mention that we were unable to pull that report from CalJobs. So we left that blank for the quarter. Okay. Therefore, it wasn't reported, but the year to date is what they had in the previous quarter.
Oh, okay. And then one other. Carry forward, I know I should know this, carry forward follow-up. What exactly is that? That's from like last year's people or what? Can you explain that?
Yes. Yeah, so the carry-ins or carry forward are basically the participants that were enrolled last program year, but are still being served this year.
Okay. Thank you.
And then Maggie, can you explain follow-up?
Yes. Yeah, so the follow-up are the participants that basically obtain placement and are done with the program, but continue to be provided follow-up services for 12 months after exit. And we continue to provide all the services to them on a monthly basis or as often as needed.
Oh, okay, thank you.
I wanna go back. Did I hear you say you'd like to ask La Habra what they're doing?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. The city of La Habra would wanna kind of weigh in on.
Adriana, can we promote Kelly?
We have Kelly and we have Diane as well.
But I think Kelly is the program, overseeing the program, so it would be Kelly that speaks. So can
Kelly,
we?
Let's see.
I think it's under Kelly F.
All right. See, Kelly, you should be able to unmute yourself. There you go.
Oh, gotcha. Thank you very much, and thank you for allowing us to be here. We apologize for what these numbers look like. I know it's not a real clear indication of how good or bad we're doing. I will say, during this last quarter, we had 7 of our 12 staff were out with COVID for at least 2 weeks. We have 2 that are now out with another illness. For more 6 weeks now we're working on. So we're trying to cover it with a city general fund staffing to make this program work a little bit better for us. We have done a lot since October-ish, once these numbers really came to light to us, where Al, who you guys know as our program manager, has been working hard, but now, like I said, we're trying to help. One of the invoice questions that was the reason we were so late is we submitted them in October and they were all rejected for some reason or another, and mostly because of we didn't provide copies of the canceled checks, which is very difficult for our city and our finance department. So we're working on policies to make that happen. As you can imagine, our city writes 1,500 or so checks a month, and so the 10, 12, or 14 that come from the WIOA program are hard for us to find, and our bank gives us one statement. So what we've done is we've asked all of our vendors to change their dates, something like our Konica lease, our SCE bill, our gas bill. So those all can be due in the beginning of the month, and that gives them time to cash the checks, and so they're all cashed at the same time. Our auditors are very concerned for us to spend money in one month and not bill it till the next month, because then we have to do it by hand and journal entries. And because they could not find any GFOA, the Government Finance Officers Association, rules to say that things should or could be done like that, our finance department was having a difficult time. We ran our numbers, and as of right now, we still have one check that hasn't been cashed in September. So we're still booking that every month, and we still haven't been able to bill for that. One check that hasn't been cleared from November, and nine checks that haven't been cashed since December. So our finance department, we're just trying to find a way to make this work. We think we've got it, but we don't know. The city has a policy, as you can imagine, that checks need to be cashed within 180 days, and then we go search them down, but they're always booked as encumbrances, but that's not good enough for now for our policy, and we're just working our way through it. So we really apologize. We have definitely spent money and worked on this program. So hopefully we'll have a report by then, well, definitely for the next quarter, but hopefully in January now. We turned them in, I think, January 8th for the rest July through December, including the three that were kicked back from October. As for performance, we're working on a number of ways to do things. You can imagine with all the COVID staffing outages, as well as our finance department outages and the youth, you know, that are just not able to come into our offices to receive services. We're trying to go as much as we can out to them. So we're working with a number of different programs. We hope to have a good January. I think that there was still only 13 new enrollments in January, but we have a lot in the queue. We're really trying to work with out-of-school youth, because the in-school youth is only 25% of our budget. As you see, the performance numbers here are very, very low. The percentages are based on a contracted goal of 600, which is a lot of students. And we have to work on that to make sure that number is even attainable. It was 600 last year when the contract was at 2.6 million. Now it's at 2.18, so a cut of about nearly 20%, but yet the contracted goal of students was still the same at 600. So we're really working hard. I'm trying not to look too much at the percentage. I really just would like the numbers and our measurable skills gains, because we know that's so easy, and it's a way for us to show you that our students and participants are learning and they are gaining and they are being served by us. We're working right now on a full reorganization of the entire program with all of our staff to make sure that we could provide coverage. For instance, one of our facilities that needs coverage to 7 p.m., but their doors close at 3. Their program closes at, closes at 5, and their program closes at 3. So we're trying to make sure that our staff are productive during those closed office hours, but they're still working at that site. We're working on a number of things with another of our partners with the out-of-school youth that are now enrolling in Pathways or CCPA and things like that. So we're hoping that our numbers increase, notwithstanding COVID and these surges and these, you know, excuses that everybody has, not just us, to make this program successful. So we hope that you'll see a big increase in the January, February, and March numbers.
This is Kathy Boyd. I have a question about when you have students in alternative education, non-comprehensive schools, would they be considered out-of-school youth, or are they still considered in-school youth? Do you know?
I'm sorry, were you going to answer, Karma?
I can chime in. It depends on how they're funded. If they're funded through K through 12, then they're considered an in-school youth.
Okay.
If they're privately funded, then they're considered out-of-school youth.
Thank you.
Carmen, just a quick question on the check situation. You know, I'm the CFO, so I have to bill a lot of contracts, and it would be problematic for me if we incur an invoice, we pay an invoice, and for whatever reason, the vendor just doesn't cash a check. Are we saying that is not a reimbursable expense if it's incurred and paid, but for some reason we just can't get the vendor to cash it?
So at times it can be. So what we ask for is receipts. So if you pay the bill and you have the receipt, it doesn't matter when the vendor cashes it, I can accept your receipt. But if you don't have a receipt and all you have to prove that it was paid is the check, then yes, I have to wait for the check. So what we try to tell the providers is try to collect receipts from the vendors. That way the receipts resolve the issue, because if a form of receipt says, yes, I have accepted form of payment, right? But if you don't have that, then unfortunately, all we have to go with is your bank statements, your credit card statements, something saying that it's been actually received by the other party and accepted form of payment. And so I think with a lot of our service providers, they don't have a mechanism to get receipts. So now we depend on the canceled check or the credit card statement.
Oh, you say, okay, a receipt that you gave it to them. Is that what you're saying? Not an invoice, but a receipt?
An invoice with a receipt, but the invoice doesn't say it's paid. So that's the problem. So invoice just says you were billed. A receipt says it was paid, or a canceled check verifies that there was a form of payment paid. We have some compliance findings back in the day where a service provider submitted an invoice to us saying that I paid this bill. We later discovered they didn't pay it at all. And now we have to give money back to the state. So in order to avoid that, we're asking them, please either give us a receipt or a canceled check or a bank statement so that we, the Workforce Development Board, doesn't get future compliance findings, because our service providers presented an invoice for cash reimbursement on an expense that didn't actually happen. So I hope that makes sense, because we've got some compliance findings regarding that. Mm. So that's why we've taken this action to ask for either a receipt, or B, a canceled check or a bank statement, just something proving that the actual payment was actually paid to that vendor using our program dollars.
Okay, when you said receipt, I thought you meant like an invoice, but you mean like you physically get a receipt.
Correct.
From the vendor, which no one really ever does anymore unless someone comes in. And
When you pay your bill, so for example, utility bill, when you pay your utility bill, the utility company does notate your account online paid. So that is a receipt, because it says paid. I can understand that some vendors don't do that online account validation or whatever. So in those situations, you're going to have to actually have a canceled check or a bank statement or a copy of a receipt. So it just depends on the vendor. But unfortunately, we've got enough compliance findings to support why we're moving in this direction. I have been, not to get into the weeds, we have a service provider currently that had to give us back $14,000 for the very same issue. That when the auditor went out and reviewed their books, realized that they received reimbursement for us for $14,000 for something that didn't actually occur.
I could, I'd like to say we're trying to work on it, so I'm not trying to complain at all. We're reorganizing the way our finance department looks at this. Excuse me, and we're trying. You know, I wish it was easier for us, but it's not, and so we'll make it work. A lot of the checks that aren't being cashed are stipend checks, so they might be $17.50 or something very small that's easy to get lost. And we're working on a way for our utility bills. It's a city government, so they just don't let us go into SCE and show a statement that says something was paid. So we really do have to wait on our canceled checks. But I think the way what we were looking at doing it was maybe only billing materials and ops in the following month and don't bill anything for 1 month. So it helps us wait, because we don't get our canceled checks until the end of the month. That's just the way the government does it here in our city. So we're working through it. I just want you to know that we're trying, and we want to comply, because I understand what unjust enrichment is and things like that. And I don't want that to occur. Again, our city encumbers the money. Once we cut a check, it'll never be respent. And if it's not cashed in 180 days, we have to go back and send another letter and try to chase it down and say, please cash your check. And if not, we have to reissue it. So the city would never get any extra money. I'm assuming maybe smaller organizations work differently, but that's the way we are. And we're going to make this work. I'm more concerned about, our numbers, that we're doing our job and we're meeting our standards, helping our students and participants. We'll work through the financial situation. I'm sorry that it's gotten this far, but we're working on that.
Yeah. Any other questions for La Habra, or we want to move on to the next performance report? All right, let's move on.
I'm going to turn it over to Adriana Ott to give you an update on the STEPS grant with Goodwill.
Okay, good.
Good morning, everyone. First off, I'm actually presenting the quarter one report because there needs to be you need to be informed of a correction. At the beginning of the fiscal year, the budget was reduced. RIOA funding was removed from the budget, and there was also an amendment that was made. So rather than a $97,070 budget, the actual budget was $52,000. The year-to-date expenses were obviously the same, but the balance should have read $43,903.25, and the percent of the budget utilized was 16%. So again, the reason for the change was removal of WIOA youth funds from this program. Funding that the foundation uses for wages wasn't changed drastically. That's not affected here. So I wanted to point that out in the Q1 report. So moving on to this quarter's report. We have the subcontractor's budget here at the new amount of $52,000. Year-to-date expenditures were the July and August invoices of $23,713, leaving a balance of $28,286.07. So at this point, 46% of the budget is utilized. Also, just to point out that this program is getting close to an end. The end of the program is going to be in this coming June. Looking at the performance, our enrollment we've met our enrollment numbers with a total of 51 year to date. So we're at 102% of performance for enrollments. New enrollments this quarter, we didn't have any. And then moving over to business services, business as work sites, let's see. We've had 35 total. So, well, that's actually the goal, but we're at 19. And let's see, completion, we're at 35. Let's see, completion has gone up. Oh, that's the way I wanted to point out our 35 number. Here it is. Our work experience students are at 35 total. Soft skills completion is at 49 total for the year. So we're making smaller strides, but it is getting toward the end of the program, but happy to say that we've met our overall goal of enrollments. And trainings, let's see, this year, 25 had started new. We have a new cohort, I believe, that started for the Ready, Set, OC entrepreneur training, and that is this 29 number here. And that's pretty much the highlights for the STEPS program at this point.
Can I step in and just remind everyone? So the STEPS program is a special grant for youth with disabilities. So the program was funded by STEPS funded or by California Foundation Funding and DOR. The intention was to provide work experience for 50 youth with individuals with disabilities. Our goal was to co-enroll them in WIOA. So when possible, any of the youth that were eligible for WIOA, the intention was to co-enroll them. Our goal was to try to find 50 youth that could be co-enrolled in WIOA, and then 50 that could be 100% funded with just the STEPS funding. To date, we only found 3 youth that could go under the WIOA track, and they've been referred over to La Habra for co-enrollment. So overall, the program has been successful because we were able to give 50 youth with disabilities the opportunity for employment placement. I think you may recall that it was very difficult to do at the beginning of the pandemic because none of them could work. So the fact that Goodwill has been able to get some of them placed and to enroll so many youth is a great thing. The challenges still exist with trying to find appropriate work sites, but I think the service provider did good with what the conditions that they were in the middle of during this pandemic. So I just wanted to highlight and remind you that this is a special grant that was very challenging from the very beginning, because we received the money at the beginning of the pandemic. A lot of challenges were, Goodwill was faced with a lot of challenges with just trying to enroll and serve this population. So the fact that they were actually able to exceed the performance goal of 50 enrollments is pretty remarkable.
Great job. Thanks for all your hard work on that. Any questions from the committee on this one?
No question, but I just want to point out that Goodwill had challenges with staffing as well. They had a number of turnovers. So despite the fact that they had those barriers and still able to place 50 of the youth with disabilities and co-enroll them is a great feat. So really I want to acknowledge that.
I'm sure Chris Stoner online is happy to hear that, the program manager for Goodwill.
Yeah, we had a regular conversation with Chris too, so we will let him know.
Okay, thank you.
Are there any questions or concerns before we move on?
Yeah, real quick, one comment. The soft skills job readiness, we really have problems even in our industry with young people coming in. There's just basic how you speak to people. How come this program probably would be good for, out-of-school youth or in-school youth, you know, seniors. I think this should be everywhere.
Well, Doug, I have good news for you. So in the
it one, is.
I have good news for you. In the One Stop Center, we purchase curriculum on soft skills. So the One Stop Center offers free soft skills training to anyone. That includes youth as well as adults. It's available virtual as well as face-to-face. I can send you that schedule so you can share with your members for those individuals that you believe could benefit from soft skills training, because we absolutely do make it available to everybody in the community.
Yeah, please. I would like that.
Okay, we'll send it to you.
Awesome. Let's move on to, do we have any more performance? I don't think so, right? That was it?
No.
Okay. We'll move on to the staff updates.
Okay, I'm going to turn it back over to Maggie to give you an update with the Youth Impact Program.
So for Youth with Impact, we actually had 5 youth that were enrolled for the 10-week program. Those youth received stipends while they attended 3 hours a week. 10 of them were on track to complete and graduate the program as of third quarter, basically. Then we also had 2110C. We had 1 youth placed during the quarter to complete their 12 weeks of paid employment training. And that youth is just about done during quarter 3 as well.
Maggie, before you advance, I want to go back to the Youth with Impact and share with the group that we are currently working with Mike Daniels with the Orange County Small Business Development Center to create grants for youth that complete our Youth with Impact program that are in WIOA so that they can start their own business. We also went to the state and asked state for permission to use WIOA supportive services to help individuals start businesses, and we got approval. So I think that this is something pretty admirable for our Workforce Development Board, the fact that we are now creating opportunities for our youth by finding them funding and making funding available to them so that they can start their own business and being able to use supportive services in that fashion. I apologize, Meg, I just wanted to bring that to their attention that we were expanding that program.
That's okay. For financial literacy, we actually had 9 youth enrolled in the Financial Literacy 5 series that was offered in partnership with Union Bank. 5 of the youth completed the 5 weeks. They learned about how to create a budget, about credit, about how to open up a bank account, how to use a debit card versus a credit card, and all that good stuff. And we are working with Union Bank to get another session started, hopefully within the third quarter as well. Do you want me to do location updates? Okay. So for Ready, Set, OC, they are currently providing services in person and virtually out of La Habra, Orangewood Foundation, MOB, and out of the Orange County Workforce Solutions Center. They're also providing services through the mobile unit by appointment only. And then as of last quarter, we've also expanded to provide services at Los Alamitos base on Fridays.
Any questions or concerns before Maggie and her updates? Adriana, do we have any updates for STEPS? I know that it's near the end.
Yeah, really just wanted to, you know, reiterate that we did make our goal for this program, and happy that 35 students have completed their WAX hours, their work experience hours. Some of the challenges that the Goodwill's working on is really trying to find employers within the geographical area of the students, because a lot of them have limited transportation. That's a challenge to find employers, potential employers that are close to them, that they have access to. That's something that the Goodwill this next quarter is going to be working on, outreach to get more employers available for WEX. So that's one of the challenges. He does have some new employers in the pipeline that were interested last quarter to get them on board for this quarter for WEX.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Are we okay to move to item number, or next item D, success stories?
Yeah, let's move on to success stories.
Did we invite anybody? I don't recall if we had, did we do Maggie? What is the individual's name so we can promote them up?
We actually have three youth. We have Rolando Reddy, which will go first. And then we have two other ones that will be joining from the same computer, Alicia Cervantes and Sergio Villalba.
Do you know what name they're under in the participant list or the
two? For Rolando Reddy, he's under his username and I sent you his email. It should be under his name. And for the other ones, they're under the Reddy Set OC.
Okay.
Diana Gomez. Excuse me.
I see Reddy Set OC.
Can we have Rolando Reddy go first? Because he has to go to work.
Find him. Andy, Anthony.
Maybe if he could raise his hand in the attendee room, we could easily identify him. There's not anyone with that name that we could see, but if you could raise your hand, that would be helpful to us.
Is Rolando with us?
So it looks like we have the other two participants possibly in the room. Ready, set, OC, if we want to start with them while we get a hold of Rolando.
Okay.
Rolando's. Yeah, we can't look it up by the email, unfortunately, Diane. I see your comment in the chat. But if he identifies himself by name, we could easily identify him, or if he raises his hand. Where the other youth, the Zoom name is right.
All right, let's start with our Ready, Set, OC youth.
Hello, my name is Alicia. I first heard about the Ready, Set, OC program through my high school. At the time, I was turning 21 and I was still struggling in high school. They told me that if I wanted to continue to be enrolled in my high school, I had to enroll into the Ready, Set, OC program. As soon as I enrolled into the program, that's when things started to change for me. For the better. A few months later, after I was enrolled into the program, I graduated high school. I spoke with my case manager, Ivana. I told her that I had graduated, that I was looking for a job, that I've been applying to places, but it was very hard for me to find a job. She told me that the program offers help with finding jobs for students. She told me about Premier Ambulance. I started working for Premier Ambulance. I still work there now. I've been there for about since December of last year. My time with the program, it's been very good for me. Because of the program, they like working for Premier Ambulance, like they're very happy with the work that I do, and they actually offered me a position there. I should be starting that, going full-time with them in February, towards like the end of February. They help me with transportation, like giving me gas cards, stuff like that. That way I can get to work and get home after work. I just want to say that I'm very thankful for the program for offering me all these opportunities and helping me with so many things. Without them, I wouldn't be able to be where I am at today. So like, I'm very thankful to have them. So that's my story. Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks for sharing.
Do we want to turn it over to the other participant?
Take off the mic so that they could hear. Okay.
Good morning. My name is Sergio Villalba. Thank you for taking your time to listen to me today. I would like to share my experience with the Ready Set OC program. I used to go to La Vista High School, and my counselor recommended me a closer school in my city that helps with graduation. Since then, this program has helped me put my life together by helping me receive my long-term job at Walgreens, helped me receive my driver's license, and thanks to God and Ready Set OC program, I'm now on path to graduate in a few months. And I just want to say I'm very thankful for everybody that has helped me, and thank you.
Thank you for sharing.
Were we able to find our last youth or the other youth? Or
he's getting on the call now. If you want to go ahead and send yours up, Adriana, for steps, do you have any success stories?
He's okay. We don't have any participants this time. Everybody's in school, so I'm over.
That's a good thing.
I'll go ahead and
we're not doing the video today, Adriana.
No. I was just going to promote Chris Stoner in case he had any input for us from the program manager.
So I want to make sure that we stick to the schedule and the intention of this. It's not for the service providers to talk, it's for participants. So can we not do that and we focus on the participants, because we do have a guest speaker today to discuss an important topic that this committee has asked for, and I want to make sure that we're able to cover that.
All right then.
Thank you.
While we're waiting for the last one, do we want to go over the grant matrix, Karma, or are we close to having...
We can go over the grant matrix. That should be pretty quick. Let's promote Erin so that she can discuss the grant matrix while we're waiting for the next year.
All right.
And then can we pull the grant matrix slide? Yeah,
thank you. Okay. Good morning. I'm going to go ahead and give you an update for this last quarter on our grants. So the first one you see there is our most recent grant award, and it's for from the state. It was a fund state funding, and it's for small micro businesses for $2,500. Grants to pay for expenses, really things that had to do with in response to COVID, to purchase some. There's some eligible expenses that they can purchase with that $2,500. So we're in the process of getting that all ready to go and set for implementation and release with applications scheduled this coming month that will go out. The next one is careers. We continue our careers grant targets dislocated workers, and that was for $3 million. And And you know, it's we're working on again implementation and getting that program set, but that will target a 2-year program. It'll target again dislocated workers and getting people back to work who are affected by COVID, and really working at the really targeting the marginalized community as well. Again, STEPS continues. We've heard that program is scheduled to end June 30. I don't know about future funding, but that may come out. VEEP continues. Again, that's our veterans program we're doing internally. That program is still going. We've got our 2 regional grants that support our regional activities and our regional organizer and the work done through the through her and through with our other 2 board workforce boards. We've got our OJT, our OJT program, again, the employment recovery program, and that continues. We've got AB 1111, again, that's adults with disabilities. That program is wrapping up this spring. If you want to go ahead and continue. And again, the P2E program that focuses on formerly incarcerated, that Santa Ana led. They were the lead on that program again, and that wraps up this spring as well. If you want to go down, Adriana. And so we are in the process of writing or working on 2 applications right now. The major one is the Good Jobs Challenge. It's Economic Development Agency money. And it's big money. It's 25 million, and so it really is looking at working with businesses and the education community and training, and setting really moving forward our industry sector work regionally across the board. So that one is due next week, and so we're wrapping up the application for for that grant. The last one is we submitted a letter of intent a couple weeks ago to the Community California Health Care Foundation, and it targets health workers and promotoras. And really, we looked at it as aligning it with our sector work, because one of our sectors that we focus on is healthcare. And so they would kind of fit into that and target that population and getting them career pathways. But it's a letter of intent. It's scheduled for release on the 7th. That by then we should hear if we are being invited to move on to the next stage and to actually submit a full proposal. So so that currently is what we're looking at with grants. Any questions? Thank you.
Questions? Okay, if there are no questions, are we able to advance the youth participants so that we can stay on track?
I'm checking to see if I see him on our list now.
Doesn't look like he's joined. They mentioned a phone number that he may be calling from, but we don't have anyone in the attendee room with a phone number.
Okay, if you don't mind to stay on track, I'd like to make sure that we cover this topic. So what we'll do is ask if he can maybe present at the next meeting, because we do have guest speakers and we're a little bit delayed in their in covering their topic. So with that said, John, is it okay if we move forward?
Yes, yeah, move forward.
All right, so the last item on the agenda is a discussion item. In the past, the board and different committees have asked for conversations on pay for performance contracts and what that could look like. So I invited Andy Hall, who was formerly with the San Diego Workforce System, as well as Third Sector Strategy, to engage with us in a conversation about pay for performance contracts, what they can look like and the benefits for pay for performance contracts and some of the challenges. So with that said, I'd like to see if we can advance Andy and Giselle and Let's see if I can see anybody else on here. Where is... Oh. Should be another member to third sector. I don't see her name on here. Ms. Thomas. Where is she? Ms. Thomas.
Gisella Thomas.
No, Ms. Yeah. I don't see her on here.
I think Maria will be joining us in 1 minute.
Okay, so she's not on.
Oh, what number? Maria Posey?
Yes.
Okay.
And then we're gonna need to provide them access to use their slides, Adriana. So can we turn over, will it be Maria that advances the slides or Giselle? Maria, you're gonna advance them? Okay, so then can we turn it over to Maria so that she has,
she should be able to share her screen now.
Perfect.
Can y'all see it?
Yes.
All right. So hello, everybody, and thank you for the opportunity to share a little bit about performance-based contracting, which we are going to, for the purposes of this presentation, call PBC. This is the team that will be chatting with you all today. It involves myself. I'm the managing director with Third Sector Capital Partners, nonprofit advisory firm that has been supporting a good number of performance-based contracting efforts with workforce boards around the country. We've had 20 plus partnerships with the workforce boards in Massachusetts, in Texas, in Virginia, in California, supporting exploration and actually design of performance-based contracting strategies. And I'm joined by my colleague, Gisella. And one of our workforce board partners, Andy Hall, who is a former CEO with your neighbor San Diego Workforce Partnership, who will share some of his experiences and lessons implementing performance-based contracting strategies. So the purpose of chatting with you all today is to consider why a workforce board may want to pursue PBC and provide a greater understanding of how performance-based contracting works, share some lessons and insights, and then equip you all to make a recommendation about performance-based contracting to vote on with the full board. So that's kind of what we're hoping to achieve with you all today. We're going to explore the why, what, and the how in this order, why you would even do it, what it is, how you do it, some lessons to consider, and then hopefully leave some time for you all to ask questions about any of the topics covered. So we're going to start with why workforce boards may want to consider performance-based contracting with a real-world example from Andy and the San Diego Workforce Partnerships as to why they chose to do it. And so I'm going to turn it over to Andy.
Thanks, Maria. And thanks, Karma, for having me. It's good to meet everybody. My name is Andy Hall. I was the Chief Operating Officer and then the Chief Impact Officer for the San Diego Workforce Partnership, your neighbors to the south, for the last 8 years. And then just like 4.5 million Americans in the month of November, I decided to quit my job. And start a little small boutique consulting firm to partner with organizations that in the workforce development space, but and really happy to be partnered up with Third Sector. They were an incredible organization and are an incredible organization in this space and helped us kind of move our strategy forward related to performance-based contracting. So we're gonna get into the mechanics here shortly, but a little bit of the why for the San Diego Workforce Partnership. And by the way, I'm still consulting with the Workforce Partnership, so I'm kind of representing them in this call, so I'll just say that. We really kind of looked at the why for us on three levels. One, on the program level, so very specifically, our WIOA metrics are important. You know, we need to get, speaking about you specifically for this committee, Getting folks enrolled in WIOA that are eligible, out-of-school youth, is an important step. Measurable skill gains and placement in education and employment is important. And retention and having supporting young people and staying engaged with education and employment is important too. And all those things are the WIOA measures are critical. But I would say we began thinking about those measures as the kind of the floor, not the ceiling, of our investments in youth in San Diego. And really, we wanted to kind of think of longer term about the big challenges our communities are facing is reducing recidivism and long-term youth disconnection in our region. So we wanted to reorient this specific program that we'll talk about in a second with WIOA funds to pay on reducing recidivism for young adults in San Diego. At the organizational level, we kind of went on this outcomes contracting journey with ultimately the goal of building a results-oriented culture and focus on funding programs that have evidence of long-term impact. And I certainly wouldn't say that we've arrived and fully accomplished that, but the idea of contracting for results has certainly changed the way we think about who, how, and for what we contract. And then finally, at the system level, this project and performance-based contracting generally creates a lot more openings, in my opinion, to drive alignment across other public systems. And in this case, probation, we had to share data, we had to share goals, we blended money to make this project work. To serve young people coming out of the justice system through a performance-based contract. And so all three of those levels were what we were thinking about. We kind of engaged with third sector, I guess, gosh, 4 years ago now, and began structuring our first performance-based contract. And yeah, we'll talk more about that specific project here in a second, but Maria, I'll turn it back to you.
Great, and I will quickly pass it on to Gisela, who will share some additional reasons, you know, that we have seen not just from the San Diego Workforce Partnership, but from other workforce boards that have embarked on similar journeys.
Thank you, Maria and Andy and everyone here. My name is Gisela Thomas. Third Sector has also shared some additional reasons why workforce boards may consider performance-based contracts. Under performance-based contracting, they can address equity issues through disaggregating data. Under a WIOA P4P contract, data is constantly collected, shared, and used for performance payments, as well as continuous program improvement. Performance-based contract can also strengthen partnerships with providers because it offers an opportunity for providers to give an input on performance-based outcomes that will impact their community. And lastly, performance-based contracts allows for organizations to help pay for what works rather than simply paying for costs. Now I'm going to pass it over back to Maria, who will talk a little bit more about PBC in WIOA.
Fine, thank you. So what is it? This is the part where we get real technical. So put on your, you know, geek nerd contracting hats and stop me if I'm going too fast. So there are three general types of contracts in WIOA. Provider operator relations. And the most common and the one that y'all are most familiar with is cost reimbursable. That is the standard, you know, you expend your funds within 2 years, you pay for the services that the provider operator, in the cost that involved, and the very much the sort of standard operating model. For performance-based contracting in WIOA, there are actually two very different approaches. One is what's called P for performance. So that is this column that we'll look at in green. And that is the approach that the San Diego Workforce Partnership embarked on as part of a national cohort of pioneers looking to take advantage specifically of the P for performance provision written into WAO's authorizing legislation. It is a very, as you guys will see as we walk through these features, mechanically complex structure. It takes a lot of work to do an actual P for performance contract, and the purpose and the reason is that it would allow you to pay performance on longer term outcomes. That is the main differentiator between a performance-based contract in sort of the standard WAO funding cycle versus what you would need to do if you wanted to pay on longer term outcomes, meaning employment 2 quarters and 4 quarters out, rather than paying on performance measures that could be achieved within the 2-year funding cycle. So the biggest difference between a performance-based contract generally and a pay-for-performance is the timing involved. Of course, I mentioned under cost reimbursement, you're paying for the costs incurred. And in both the performance-based and pay-for-performance options, you are paying for outcomes. But in a performance-based, this blue column, you can actually pay on milestones. So this is what, you know, San Diego Workforce Partnership did. There were different amounts assigned to enrollment and achieving skills gain and placing in employment. You know, you can benchmark your payments according to a schedule that spans the entire engagement with a particular workforce youth customer. For pay for performance, you have to benchmark, you have to pay on the WIOA standard performance indicators. And since it's a time thing, the only ones you're really paying on is 2 quarters out and 4 quarters out. So that is what you're paying on if you are doing a pay for performance contract. Most workforce boards in the country are not, you know, familiar with these differences in terminology, and pay for performance has kind of become the catch-all phrase. But we have consulted with the Department of Labor for, gosh, over like 20 hours now to really, truly understand what stands behind the guidance, the TEGL, the training guidance letter that they have issued on pay for performance, and understand that really what they mean is payment on 2 quarters and 4 quarters out, which is very different than just the paid performance-based approach. For cost reimbursement, a lot of times data ends up being collected for reporting purposes because DOL asks us to. Sometimes it is also used for continuous improvement and learning. But if you're operating under a performance-based contracting structure, the learning aspect almost becomes essential since that's what you're driving towards. And that starts to get some of the culture change that Andy's talking about, is that if you are collectively agreeing with the operator and provider that you will be having these sort of financial ties to a actual outcome and a results, then the conversations around how to get there change. And then mechanically on the contracting side, it ties back to the payment structure, which is you are writing the contract differently, whether you are paying on performance or paying on costs. So the payment schedule for that would be included in the contract. In all instances though, you would be expecting the provider operator to offer the services required under each of the WIOA title approaches. So it's not that there's suddenly there, you know, you're doing something incredibly different, but the incentive to collaborate and coordinate and engage with other service providers is greater if what you're driving for is performance rather than services. I'll pause there for a second and see if anyone wants to jump in with a question. Otherwise, moving on to future discussion. All right, hearing none, we're gonna hear how this all played out more specifically in San Diego.
Yeah, thanks, Maria. And I think, you know, part of the goal here is that, like, the discussion, basically the board does a lot of work structuring a good contract. And then that should, in theory, open the provider up to like being creative, flexible, and innovative and responsive to their customers and serve in getting outcomes. Because all of a sudden, the conversations with providers isn't about, you know, can we see your staffing structures and payroll records and your invoice backups, but rather like why aren't these folks getting enrolled in place so that we can pay you? And I think that gives a lot of freedom on the kind of compliance side, if done correctly, to really focus on what matters, which is results for kids, youth, young people. So in San Diego, that was kind of our goal, is put all that work up front and have our contractor, which in our scenario was Second Chance. Our youth system, maybe I should contextualize this project a little bit. We have about our youth, we owe a youth allocation is about $80 million or $8 million, I should say. The San Diego Workforce Budget is about $40 million, and about half of that money is WIOA. And of that $20 million of WIOA, about $8 million, $7 to $8 million, depending on the year, is the youth allocation. And so we've procured a network of youth contractors, just like you all do. After competitively procuring those contracts, I guess this was 2015 now, I think, we said, who's interested in kind of going down this path with us? And Second Chance was. And so we restructured their contract after procuring them to be a $2 million over a 4-year contract, serving 16 to 24-year-olds who were not in school, who had been adjudicated and had a true finding of a criminal conviction, and then is in field services or in reentry from basically is coming out of the juvenile system. And the goal was to do all the things that we do in WIOA and bottom left here, reduce recidivism. So we wanted to, that was kind of our main goal in partnership with the probation department here in the county, was we want to see the 320 kids going through this program have a lower recidivism rate than a comparable set of 320 kids who are not going through this program. And then one of the biggest, I think, knocks on performance-based contracting generally is cash flow challenges for your provider. So, you know, you don't get paid until outcomes are generated, which can take a long time. So working with Third Sector, we designed a payment milestone process that kind of solved that problem a little bit. So we paid on new enrollments and monthly reports as one of the milestones. So after 1 month, Second Chance gave us their first report about how the program is standing up. And then we were able to pay them on that milestone and help with some of their cash flow issues right off the bat before some of these longer term outcomes are achieved. And then you see the other payment milestones, which I don't need to read through. And so we did all the work to kind of structure this this program, and the referral partners with probation. And in fact, probation kicked in some money to help fund the program. And kind of off we went. And we were kind of doing this without guidance from the federal government. All we had was that the WIOA law encouraged and allowed for this, but we were kind of taking a little bit of risk of going forward without guidance. In fact, and now, as Maria mentioned, there is a TEGL law that talks a lot more about how this could or should work. But we decided to kind of take that risk and take that jump and go for it. So the contract was launched. I would say, looking back, we went from kind of 100% cost reimbursement across our entire system to turning one contract into a P4P contract with a fairly complex evaluation structure. We kind of went from 0 to 100 really fast. Looking back, and some lessons learned is to like build up to a fully structured contract like this. I can talk about that if that's interesting. But for now, I think this is enough to kind of give you a flavor of what we did, and I'll turn it back over to the Third Sector team.
Thanks so much, Andy. So that's kind of, you know, what the PBC model can look like in practice. we now want to get into a little bit on sort of how you actually do it. And the first thing we want to share is the timeline involved, you know, because unfortunately we've seen workforce boards at, you know, local area level, as well as state workforce boards. We got called in from the state workforce board, Texas Workforce Commission, to essentially review a performance-based RFP that they were going to be releasing 2 weeks later. And we were like, wait a minute, because if you suddenly infuse a performance requirement into an RFP without ensuring sufficient sort of buy-in and agreement and alignment with, you know, provider capabilities, with, you know, third parties, you know, that may be involved, whether it's to, you know, because you're serving similarly high need customers, it's going to shock the system and likely become a, you know, a recipe for, or a higher risk of crash. And we actually had a conversation with the City of Duluth's workforce board just a couple weeks ago, and they wanted to spend an hour talking to us about what a horrible idea performance-based contracting was, because it came down from a city mandate to do this. And it was implemented sort of in a punitive oversight type of way that essentially added an additional level of distrust rather than building trust with providers, holding funding hostage essentially until outcomes were achieved, which gets to the risk of, you know, cash flow. It's simply too much of a risk for providers to do work, you know, given the uncertainties. So time is really important when thinking about implementing something like this. And then another thing Andy said is just, you know, allowing yourself to go incrementally. And this is, you know, where having somebody like Third Sector can really support that effort. You know, we've heard from pretty much everybody that support, you know, we're not going to hide the fact that we're part in here to advocate for our own value in these kinds of transformations. And, you know, doing that procurement for essentially a group like us, there are a few others like us that do this kind of support. And then doing the work to plan for the contract, developing the scope, evaluation criteria, coming up with exact amounts that seem reasonable. You know, that's a variable of like, how much money are you actually assigning to each milestone? You know, overall work planning, you know, who is the population that you would be looking to, you know, likely not your entire youth population, maybe a particularly underserved subset. In California's instance, getting EDD approval for this before releasing an RFP. In the case of San Diego, despite initial collaboration from EDD, the lack of federal government guidance made it very hard to, you know, actually see the full project through. And EDD played a part in that as well. So confirming their approval, and then, of course, releasing the RFP. And so really talking about a timeline of incorporating a PVC framework into next year's procurement cycle. So these are all sort of like the activities that go into developing an actual PVC contracting strategy. And then for you all, the options after conferring with Karma seem to be the youth program being maybe the, you know, the easiest place to put this, since the program would need to be reprocured next year anyway. So, you know, there wouldn't need to be an off-cycle program procurement. Although that is also an option to do. And so it could take the form of incorporating it into youth. It could be its own special project or grant, or it could be included in adult dislocated worker or Title I operator, which would require the latter two to go through an off-cycle procurement. So that's kind of the overview of how of what it is and how you do it. Before turning it over to you all for questions, we just quickly want to share some lessons again from San Diego and then also from the other pioneer in Virginia, which was the other workforce board to take the contract to full launch out of a cohort of five initial workforce boards. So back to you, Andy.
Yeah, I think hearing questions would be important. So I think the only thing I'll say in addition to the bullets, I think the idea of going down this path is like it's a long-term journey investment that requires culture and competency shift with contractors and staff. And I would say it's a worthwhile journey. I mean, I think there's good, everyone has examples of good cost reimbursement contracts and bad cost reimbursement contracts and well-performing performance-based contracts and poor-performing performance-based contracts. I'd say, you know, the details obviously matter. But I think the general direction of paying for outcomes is a place that the public system needs to move towards. And it's a worthwhile journey, if not a difficult one. So I'll stop. That's all I have, Maria.
I think that's good. And I think, you know, the insights from Virginia pretty much mirror what you've already shared. And so that's probably a good place to open up for questions.
So I just want to share with the committee that there's no decision that needs to be made today. My intention is to present this to you, present the same topic to the one-stop committee, then to the full board so that the entire board has an opportunity to dig in at their level and address questions or concerns so they have a better understanding before we start exploring it as an entire board. So with that said, please ask as many questions as you like because I want to make sure that we have a full understanding before we make decisions as a workforce system.
I'm assuming that you still have to justify your costs. Is that correct? Or is it just truly, okay, you hit this performance measure, you get this money, and there's no documentation on the cost?
Yeah. Yeah, I can, Maria, will you tell me if you want me to take that one?
Go.
So I think they're still kind of written into the Code of Federal Regulations that costs must be reasonable and applicable to the grant objectives. And so but that's, you know, that's pretty easy to put together that analysis. You can look at historical data for how much was this contract and how many people did they serve in place to get a general cost per placement anchor. And then you can also do kind of other analyses on, you know, what is the average caseload size we want for this intervention? What's the going rate for a case manager in Orange County? And then what's the typical admin expenses over that? And then you can kind of triangulate cost reasonableness in that way too. And so you do have to do that, but it's not that difficult.
And the vendor doesn't have to submit backup of any sort?
That's the thing, right? Is if you are truly doing a performance-based contract, and you have agreed on what reasonable cost metrics are, then that's it. Then you don't have to track bus tickets and garden hoses and anything else that you're spending for achievement of those outcomes. The only exception is if you're doing a combination, which is what some workforce boards choose to do. So if you're doing, you know, a cost reimbursement on like a base grant and then using performance for more of like a bonus system where, you know, well, we'll pay you for your services, but, you know, if you achieve what we agree to be reasonable, you know, performance metrics, then we'll give you this additional sum. Then in reality, those are really two different contracts, even though they may be written into one agreement. And so for the part that would be cost reimbursement, you would have to track costs because it's cost reimbursement. For the part that's bonus, that's performance. So you would have to track performance. But if you do what the San Diego Workforce Partnership did, and maybe it's a smart to work your way up to that and make your entire contract performance-based, then you do not have to track individual expenses.
The challenge I want to remind you guys, the challenge is the service provider's ability to basically front the business, keep the business operating until they meet the performance metrics, whatever they may be.
And that's where you could make it as simple as, enrollment. Initial project plan could be a payment point.
It's just a comment. I'm really excited about the shift, the possible shift from that compliance orientation to that outcome orientation. The several examples that were shared, it's just really exciting. Thank you, Karma, for bringing this to our attention. I think it's a healthy way to move forward. Go ahead, Mark or John.
I was just going to ask, what do you do? And I mean, obviously, we're in 2+ years now of COVID, and performance has taken a huge hit. Is there a force majeure clause or some other kind of clause that you guys have inserted for unexpected types of events?
Yeah, I think there's like I think we do our standard templates have kind of some of that language in there. And I think part of the idea is that like you kind of develop, potential to develop a relationship with your contractors around outcomes in a way that doesn't happen under a cost revert. And so you can kind of talk through that, like, hey, we want to pay you because we want youth in our or in our community to get these results. COVID just happened. Like, how can we help you get these results in a different way? And or let's get back to the negotiating table and restructure this in a way that makes more sense. I think all those things, are potentially on the table. It's on the provider to also be, the provider has a little more flexibility on how they respond to those things. If it's a performance-based contract, because they don't have to get permission to have reimbursement for a staff who's working out of state whatever the case may be. That's a bad example, but generally, I think the providers can have more flexibility in responding to things that come up as well. Like, for example, in San Diego, our cost reimbursement contracts have to go through a whole, if someone wants to change their staffing model, there's a whole like approval process. And so when COVID happened, like, you might need a different staffing model to serve these young people in a remote setting, or you need to make investments in technology. And in our cost reimbursement contracts, we had to like really structure those things differently, approve them. And after several months, maybe they could do those things, but a performance-based contractor could just do them, thinking that that's the best way to get those results.
Just being I've been a contractor now for multiple contracts at state, county, federal level. It's just such a different way of looking at it. And there obviously is a lot of risk on the nonprofit side or the entity that contracts if for whatever reason they're not able to meet certain performance measures. Karma, the potential cash flow issues I'm just thinking through.
And that is why they're at the table, right? So even though you might not be able to chat with them during an active RFP process, there would need to be some sort of, RFI or pre-bidding or some way to, legally get their input into the design. And then also have a period after award where the actual, exact mechanics and amounts are agreed upon so that you mitigate that risk.
And I think too, Maria, this hasn't materialized yet, but I'd like to see a world where there's other financing coming into this ecosystem where there's a lot of revolving loan funds, philanthropy that could come in. like no interest line of credit from a city or a county, but these things are out there. They're in the construction business, who have the same challenges, and that could add an extra level of diligence on a program design's efficacy and evidence of outcomes if a third party was willing to finance a project up front and be repaid if and only if outcomes are achieved. That's the type of ecosystem I think that could be considered if once a board goes down this path, if that makes sense, or just, you know, straight philanthropy could also be in the mix and just help with the first 6 months or whatnot.
So that's called a pay for success contract and is an additional layer. It has potential, you know, because it then essentially completely de-risks the provider's engagement because they're getting paid based on costs from a third party, and you all would only be responsible for repaying that third party if the agreed upon outcomes were achieved. So, you know, it's a good idea for you guys. And there are lots of groups like this, you know, Macom Capital, Illumina Capital, like we, Third Sector has negotiated several of these pay for success contracts. The only thing is that you probably have to add 6 months because then you have a third party that also needs to be part of those negotiations and sign on the dotted line at the end.
Mm-hmm. So you brought up construction. This reminds me kind of a construction contract where payments are made based on the project progressing. But, you know, in construction, it's so tangible. You watch the building go up and different things happen. So this is very similar. But I imagine, let's say, for the workforce, that watching this will act in a different way. We typically watch the money and we do watch a little of the performance, but this will really put oversight over performance. I mean, I like it. I think it really sounds different, and we probably do have to try different things right now because the same old doesn't seem to be, you know, moving us. But it's gonna require a whole different viewpoint of oversight.
I just wanted to chime in that, just as a reminder, because I've mentioned this before, that when it comes to a workforce board, the theory is that only 10% of our money should be WIOA. We should be getting money from other sources so that we can do more. And so unfortunately, it's pretty much 100% of our funding, if not 99%, is WIOA, which limits us. So as a workforce board, we really need to think about that the strategy should be for us to expand beyond WIOA being our only resource.
Is this kind of heading to a, you know, it almost sounds like in the construction for profit, but you know, nonprofits are used to getting a grant, implementing a little bit, giving you some, you know, hopefully get some outcomes, the money's expended, but this really starts putting the onus on the provider to really, you know, provide and to show real success. It's interesting.
With the examples that you shown, I mean, does it reduce, I'm not sure how much experience you have, but does it reduce the amount of RFP responders? Like, no?
Or Carmen, go ahead, sorry.
I was gonna say, I don't know that to be true or false because it depends on the service providers who are responding and their capability of producing the outcome. So for example, if I don't think I can produce outcomes, I'm not going after it. I'm going to stick with the contracts that I know I get paid no matter what happens, right? But if I am really good at what I do and I know I can do it, of course I'm going to respond back because that's an easy challenge for me. I've done this. I have a proven record of being able to produce outcomes in this area. So I think that it might be a shift of what Doug said, the same old, in terms of providers who go after our contracts, get them and give us the same outcomes versus somebody who's really competitive, has proven experience in delivering this and goes after it. I also think that it may not be as hot. So, you know, where our contracts ask you to serve 600 people, it probably won't be that many people because I don't know that anybody has, I haven't met anybody yet that's able to provide outcomes for 600 people in confidently say I can do that. So maybe there are some, maybe they're not. Andy, what did you guys receive in terms of responses?
I was going to say, like, I think we put out one RFP that had like specific rates that we thought were like the right ones. And in that one, we didn't get, that was an adult contract, but we didn't get the competition that we wanted. And the learning from that was like our next RFP. Our learning from that is like, and this is perfectly allowed as long as you structure it and communicate in the right ways with the right people. We put out like, hey, our intention is to do a performance-based contract. Here are some kind of ideas of where we think the rates are going to be. But we, like, once the provider is selected, like, we want to negotiate in good faith, because you're going to bring up things that we might not be thinking about to make this work. And so I think when we structure our RFPs in with that language and with that tone, we've found the field to be more competitive and more responses. But when we did the first example where I said, and it was kind of like, this is what we're paying, like, who wants to do it? It kind of didn't, it wasn't a successful RFP basically. And so I think writing it in a way that is like, we want to pay for outcomes, but we understand this is complicated and we want to work with you on it, is I think a better path.
And so it really changes the dynamic just from oversight to partnership, right? Like, you guys are responsible for, yes, overseeing your providers, but at the end of the day, everybody's working towards improved outcomes and, you know, for the groups that you want to serve. So this is like a mechanical operational way to sort of formalize some of that shared intention.
Would there be any entities that their governing board or entity would not allow them to respond to an RFP like this? So for example, City of La Habra is our youth provider and they're a government entity. Are they allowed to respond to a performance-based grant like this?
Okay. Yeah, in fact, that's the case in Virginia. The provider for their performance contract is the Department of Family Services, the you know, local family DSS office.
So I just want to chime in, John. The individuals who can respond back are probably going to be the same. So you can have community colleges respond back, for-profit companies, nonprofit companies, almost anybody can respond back to RFPs. And I think that a cost or performance-based contract allows for-profit companies to see the value of doing it, because where I usually get in the weeds of where you're spending the money, for-profit companies probably don't want me to do that. So if it's based on performance, then I'm not in the weeds of it. I don't know what you're doing, how much it costs you to do it. I just pay you for doing it. So I think it does open up more people to come to the table when you do a performance-based contract than some of those cost reimbursement contracts, because we do in fact get in the weeds with those.
Okay.
So this is the beginning of the conversation, because remember, I plan on having it with each committee and again with the full board. This is your opportunity. I know that sometimes in the full board meetings, we all get to talk. So this is your opportunity to get into it with Third Sector and ask Andy questions about his experience. We will continue this conversation because I think that, like I said, we as an entire board need to consider this. We've all kind of mentioned it before. So this is our opportunity to really dig in. Do we want to do this? Like they said, the first opportunity that we will have to do a performance-based contract would be the youth program, because we're up for procurement next year on that one. If we do decide to move forward, I don't know, Maria, if we could go back to that timeline so they can see it again, how long it's probably going to take. So, you know, our contracts run from July through June. And so there's a process we have to, of course, put out an RFP, of course, through the planning process, put out the RFP, then it has to go in front of the Board of Supervisors. So there is a lot of steps between an RFP and contracting for us. And now with this concept, it's a few more steps because we have to do the planning, like really design and plan what we want it to be. In addition, we still have to ask EDD for permission. So I just want to make sure that you guys have a visual of this, because if we do, as a board, decide to go forward, youth will likely be the first one.
All right. Really good information. Yeah.
You guys will see us again then at the full board meeting. You'll see some of these slides again. You know, you'll be the experts. We'll call on you to help deliver the message. No, we won't call on you.
And just one more comment. Your PowerPoint is excellent. I love that everything is on the page and is there as you go. Most PowerPoints that I do, the one page at a time shows up and you're always trying to go back and forth. That's an excellent PowerPoint. Thank you.
I mean, as a nonprofit consulting company, we live and breathe PowerPoints, right? But thank you very much. And this is also, you know, so you know, Karma's not paying us anything to, you know, come and talk to you all. It's purely, you know, for two purposes. Number one, to, you know, because we believe this is a transformational approach, and we believe as a nonprofit organization that these system changes can really make a difference in the lives of youth and in the law, you know, in the administration, you know, around public systems. So that is the first reason. The second reason, of course, is to hopefully have a chance to work with you all. And now you all have a chance of experiencing what it would be to work with us.
So Karma, I'm assuming you're a fan of this. Is one of the reasons you're bringing it to us? And have you had experience with this in the past?
We actually have one right now. So funny you should ask. So under our adult dislocated worker program for the Workforce Board, we tried a performance-based contract with the one-stop operator. I think that I've learned from Andy's, like what Andy said, I'm shaking it in my head that, you know what, it's one thing when you plan it all and then you get a provider who has a hard time conceptualizing what you're trying to accomplish. So we did two things with that one. We brought in a mall operator, but then we put performance metrics on top of it. And I think that as a result of that, that contract is not going as well as it should, because it was two brand new concepts brought to this workforce system. And I think that it might have been too much, meaning that the mall operator is the way we should go, but I don't know if we should have put a performance-based contract on there. I think at the time we felt we needed to in order to change the structure, but they haven't met any of the performance metrics. So I think we're learning from that. We can talk about that a little bit more, but I think we've learned, like what Andy said, like, you know, it's one thing to bring a new concept of performance base to the program. It's a whole nother thing when you bring in a mall manager. Now the contract that America Works has with us is cost plus performance. So we reimburse them for the cost of operating the one-stop center for us, but then their performance metrics for helping us meet our goals, like bringing in system partners. So if they're able to bring in and fill up the one-stop center with all 17 mandatory partners plus community-based organizations, they receive $10,000. Unfortunately, they haven't been able to do that. Now, there are many reasons why they might not have been able to do that. The pandemic could have been one of them. And the concept of a mall operator is new to California. We normally don't have operators in that capacity. They usually just facilitate meetings for us. But we're asking for someone to actually manage our locations, bring in partners, and provide training so that the training is open to all the public. So it may have been too much. And we can look at that a little bit further. They haven't met the performance metrics. However, I don't think that, I think that it was a good idea. I just think that maybe it was too much at once.
What about other county offices? Have they implemented similar type of programs that you're aware of? Or?
So I think in California, San Diego is the only one I heard has a cost, a performance-based contract. Now, I will tell you that in my old life, we tried them and they didn't necessarily work. We tried them under WIA. And the problem that we have with WIA is that they were hoarding clients through, meaning that every single participant got the exact same program so they can get the payment. And the problem with that, it wasn't individualized career services. So remember, we're trying to meet each person as an individual and provide them unique services based on their needs. Well, the problem that I had in the past with contracts like this is that the service provider was focused on numbers and money. So what happened is everybody got the same program. So everybody went through the same training. Everybody went through the same resume writing so that they can hit performance metrics. I think that by using an organization like Third Sector to help us create a model, we might get a better outcome. But I can tell you that there were challenges in the past. And I think that By having an organization that does have experience creating them across the United States and really believes in this work, I think maybe we'll get a better outcome. There's pros and cons.
Just like Andy said, they're good and they're bad. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can't account for everything, but that's why it's so important to set up some of these, you know, quote, softer structures around it, around continuous improvement and learning, so that you don't end up in a situation where you implement a performance-based contract and then 3 years later say, oops, it didn't work, right? Like that you're, as these things start to, you know, as, you know, questions, potential challenges come up, there's a collaborative, trusted relationship, you know, between you guys and the providers, so that you're looking at data together, you're brainstorming solutions together, and you're course correcting along the way. You know, that is, I think, a real insight to all of this too. It's not, you know, well, we'll pay you for performance, bye, come back to us, you know, when you've done it. It's an ongoing conversation.
And Karma, you have the support of county council, the board, and supervisors in terms of this type of arrangement? I mean, I'd hate for us to go through this whole thing and then they go
Not yet. So what I'm trying to do is see if we even want to go down this path before we even ask for permission, because it doesn't make sense for me to go to the board of supervisors or anyone else if you're not even interested. So no, I don't. And like I said, I still have to go to EDD, but I don't want to start I don't want to get the ball rolling without making sure this is where you even want to go. So I think it's important to educate you with what is this, how does it work, what are our options? And yeah. Then, okay, Carmen, let's explore it. Let's go down the path of asking the supervisors. Let's go down the path of getting EDD's buy-in.
Yeah, if we've never heard of the idea, we'll never start anywhere. So yeah, it's good to get in line. I just think, you know, you're going to have to change the whole mindset of how the nonprofit world works. And I'll use an analogy of construction again. You know, somebody puts up, I've got $100 million, I want a science building at UCI, and a company comes in and bids for it and gets it. They don't expect to get the $100 million up front and then divvy it out, you know. And I think this is similar, but, you know, nonprofits just aren't used to doing that, and, you know, where they get the financing. I mean, I like the model, but I think it's going to turn how our providers normally contract with us. And it's worth exploring, in my opinion, but it's going to take some real effort.
We don't have to jump all in. So we can try to do small contracts. We can focus on maybe foster youth or justice involved youth, like one population, and see how it goes and expand. I don't want you to think that we have to go all in. We don't. And we can look for outside funding. So if we don't want to fund this with WIO and we want more flexibility in what we do, we can look for that. There's lots of money coming down the pipeline from many places to focus on workforce development and the future of our workforce system. So I don't know that it has to be all WIO. There are other opportunities.
And that was really what San Diego was looking for initially as well, right? Like a subset of the overall youth that historically might have more barriers. And for the incentive that exists, that's already in existence for providers to, you know, achieve performance numbers, thereby possibly creaming, right? You know, serving those that are most likely to achieve them. This tool can also be a way to specifically target some of those people that otherwise might inadvertently get excluded as a starting point.
I mean, to John, the question on the county and the board of supervisors is a good one. In Karma, I think what you said totally makes sense, and it was our experience in San Diego too. And I think I would say it's likely that the county Health and Human Services Agency is either there or quickly moving to value-based or outcomes-based contracting through the health plans. And there's a big movement in the California healthcare system related called CalAIM, which is moving very rapidly in healthcare terms, like the next 8 years, towards reimbursement rates based on health outcomes and reimbursing county health providers and behavioral health providers on outcomes. And so I think I would imagine county council and the Health and Human Services Agency, or however it's precisely named and organized in your county, has some competency in looking at these in the healthcare space and maybe the other human service space too. So that was certainly true in San Diego.
All right, Karma, anything else on this or?
No, I don't have anything else. Like I said, we're going to continue this conversation. It's not something that I expected for us to make a decision today. I think I just wanted to plant the seed so you can start thinking about it. So as we meet, as we, you know, explore this further, that you can grow in your understanding of what it is and the pros and cons.
All right. Well, thank you, Maria, Andy, whole team there. Thank you for your expertise. And this is a, yeah, it was a great discussion.
Thanks so much, guys.
I think the last item is just kind of an open discussion if there's anything else that anyone wanted to address, right? Anyone have anything? All right, should I make a call for adjournment then?
I think so.
Do we do a vote on that, or is it, do I just officially get... Do I act as a dictator and just say, you know, we're done?
You can just say you're done.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody. It was a great conversation. And I look forward to hearing more about this. And appreciate all of your contributions to the Youth Committee.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Right. Bye. Bye-bye.